This is the 321st edition of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George, British Columbia. Without further ado, here I go. In these days of falling government revenues and increased costs of recovering from our economic collapse, we all have to chip in and do our bit. Yes, sir, every taxpayer is obliged to cough up that last dollar owed just because it's the right thing to do. And because Revenue Canada catches you cutting corners, the full force of government will come down around your ears. Oh, this applies to individuals of small means only, of course. Corporations have their lobbyists, bought parliamentarians, shifty accountants, and immoral executives who aim to pay as little as possible for the government that serves their interests so assiduously. Let the little guy pay the expenses of governance, while corporations run off with barely taxed profits. A few years ago, a Canadian telecommunications company was exposed for its use of transfer pricing. The scheme is common and lucrative. Canadian companies now have some 1,200 affiliates in tax havens for the purpose of hiding profit from the tax man. In this particular case, the company scheme was simple. They manufactured telephone handsets here. This was a long time ago. Selling them to a subsidiary in a tax haven at a price barely above cost. Therefore, they made no taxable profit on the deal. Without ever taking physical possession, the subsidiary resold them to another Canadian branch of the corporation for a price barely below that charged the end user. No profit on this end either. The profit was made entirely by the wholly owned middleman in a jurisdiction where taxes were minuscule. The result? Huge profit, tiny tax. This was a simple scheme. Since those innocent days, transfer pricing has become so sophisticated that forensic auditors have the devil's own time sorting them out, if they're allowed the time and money to try. Many governments of developed countries, with Canada's in the forefront, largely ignore transfer pricing as a tax dodge. Obama has proposed a Stop Tax Haven Abuse Act, which may or may not staunch the flow of untaxed profits to offshore countries. I'm not holding my breath that Harper follows suit. A study by the University of Quebec, reported in the CCPA Monitor, found that the big five Canadian banks used offshore affiliates to avoid paying $16 billion in taxes between 1993 and 2003. In the States, Citigroup, recipient of $45 billion in rescue funds from their government, has 427 subsidiaries in tax haven countries. 427. I can't imagine the work necessary to ever untie that Gordian knot. Then there are the wealthy individuals. It's estimated that the world's wealthiest people have over $11 trillion parked in tax havens where they escape taxation in their home countries to the tune of $250 billion each year. But they're pikers compared to companies which stash between $700 billion and $1 trillion in those same tax havens each year. We Canadians have no political party in power or aspiring to power with the gumption to face the rich and their corporations, forcing them to repatriate their money for taxation. No party would seriously work to close the loopholes by which taxes are legally avoided. And few Canadians really give a good damn. All of our family income is reported, with the exception of funds from found beverage containers. I hope this admission doesn't get me busted. An honest accountant, no kidding, prepares our income tax returns, and we cough up immediately. I have a lot of fears, but fear of a tax audit's not among them. Each year, we receive an assessment and tax bill for our home in Prince George. We pay on receipt of the bill. If I were to dispute our assessment, I would use an appeal process, the decision of which is final. If I fail to pay my property tax on time, I'll be charged interest at a prohibitive rate. In the event that I continue avoiding payment beyond a certain time, my property will be seized and sold for amounts owing. It's a simple system that works smoothly. But I'm a mortal citizen, not a corporation. Corporations are treated differently. A company can be granted a deferment, allowing them to put off paying their way. I don't know the amount carried on government books, municipal, provincial, and federal, as deferred corporate taxes, but it's substantial. And sometimes a company will outright refuse to pay money owing. The Zelsoft Celgar paper mill in Castlegar, a subsidiary of Mercer International Germany, refuses to pay the city $2.7 million in property taxes. They say this is too much and demand that it be reduced. Until then, they withhold payment. This company is not alone. It joins Catalyst, which is withholding over $19 million in taxes owing to mills in Powell River, Campbell River, Port Alberni, and Crofton. Will municipal government seize these delinquent mills and sell them for taxes owing? Not a chance. They will negotiate lower rates as they kiss the corporate butt. Why? Well, because they create jobs. This seems odd to me because I would imagine there's a corporation out there, China, Korea, maybe the States, would pony up the tax money if it meant getting a mill for pennies on the dollar, and they would continue to employ workers to run it. What we need is a municipality with the cojones to seize one of these properties for resale. That would end the practice of corporate extortion pretty quickly. The European Union now forbids the import of seal products from Canada. The response of Harper's government is that complaints are unfounded as the annual slaughter of seals is, quote, humane, unquote. This explains a lot. I recall films of white coat seal pups clubbed to death as their mothers watched helplessly. I watched as seals were skinned alive. These acts fall within the ambit of conservatives' rather broad definition of humane. With this as a standard, who can object to the treatment of Afghan prisoners or even Canadian citizens shipped overseas for torture? Our soldiers routinely turn captives over to the tender mercies of Afghan torturers, but they don't beat them to death as far as we know. Even if they did, it would be humane according to conservative standards. Mayor Arar and Abdel Razak were mistreated to a degree, but they weren't skinned alive. Omar Khadr has been a guest in Guantanamo since being shot in the back by an American soldier, but he's enjoyed free room and board. Chikansky was killed by Taser in Vancouver Airport, but it wasn't done with his mother while his mother watched. What's with all these bleeding heart liberals whining about human rights and such? Canada treats people humanely, by conservative definition, of course. While we sweat the fate of humane seal killing, Americans ponder the morality of murdering enemies overseas. It's long been accepted down there that they have a sovereign right to kill Fidel Castro. CIA has tried many times. After all, didn't he expropriate mafia-owned casinos? During the Bush years, a plan was cooked up for the CIA to selectively eliminate al-Qaeda personnel in foreign lands. It was canceled by Obama, but questions remain. Congress is distressed, not at the arrogance leading the executive to murder, but because they were not informed. As of the 70s, it's a law that they be told when assassinations are ordered. Congressmen have their rights, you know, even if foreign perceived enemies don't. The United States feels it has the right to kill anyone, anywhere, as they are at war. War against whom or what? War against terror. Terror, however, is a tactic, not a solid enemy. And the weapon of choice against terror is terror of a different stripe. Congress cannot grasp the inversion of their right to kill enemies. If they have that right, then others have a reciprocal right to kill American enemies in their homeland. Say, isn't this what those 19 men did when they attacked the Pentagon and the World Trade Center? Didn't these buildings represent the economic and military power of the U.S. that was the perceived enemies of their religion? Sauce for the goose is sauce for the gander. By the barest of majorities, Canada's Supreme Court ruled that Hutterites in Alberta must be subject to photographing for driver's licenses. The Hutterite brand of fundamentalism claimed that photography violates the Second Commandment for forbidding idolatry. Nuts. If they want to follow a literal interpretation of those commandments, maybe they shouldn't drive at all. I would read the prohibition of stealing as covering the burning of gasoline. Isn't that theft of energy stored in the ancient past and a further theft of resources from our progeny? Get real. We can't cater to every nutty superstition that some cult dreams up. We already bow to cults and religions too much by exempting them from taxes. We live in a secular society, and those who want government by divine fiat are free to move to Saudi Arabia. 2.5 years ago, I fronted up at Prince George's local gambling den, signing up for the British Columbia Lottery Corporation's voluntary self-exclusion program. As a subject of this innovation, I am prohibited from entering the hallowed halls of any casino in British Columbia until February of 2010, at which time I suppose I will be considered cured of my frightful urge to blow my coin in demon slot machines. I was sternly warned that if found in one of these premises, I will be ejected on the first offense and fined for subsequent ones. The fine seems an odd deterrent, as everyone crossing the threshold of a casino is subject to an implicit fine for attempting to violate the law of averages. Could there not be other candidates for self-exclusion programs? A similar one for recovering alcoholics would be a natural, whereby the volunteer would be ejected from any liquor store or pub, with the onus being on these establishments to use facial recognition technology for identification. But here's my favorite. It would exclude recovering religious fanatics from any house of prayer. Think of the recent escapee from a religious cult trying to slip into a church, synagogue, mosque, or whatever for a fix of fantasy. If he or she could be identified and turned away, hope of recovery would be intensified. Waivers might be granted for functions like weddings and funerals, but the prohibition would otherwise be strictly enforced. Violators would be forced to tithe the Freedom from Religion Foundation for a year. I'd sign up for that program, although there's scant chance that I would ever test its efficacy. Another exclusion program I tested was the procedure for dumping my residual U.S. citizenship. When I became a Canadian some 32 years ago, American law did not recognize dual citizenship. Anyone swearing loyalty to another nation automatically lost his or her precious U.S. nationality, period. A subsequent challenge before the Supreme Court determined that the State Department had overstepped its powers by revoking citizenship without an official renunciation. Thus, some hundreds of thousands of Americans who had taken other nationalities were thrown into a legal limbo, wherein they might or might not still be Americans, depending on their mental state at the time. Anyone who could prove he or she accepted another citizenship with reservations and without the intention of rejecting the U.S. did not lose citizenship. It was a muddied situation. I chose to clarify mine. As the fruit of swapping paper for 7 years with American bureaucrats, culminating in a solemn session and swearing of oaths in the Vancouver U.S. consulate, I am officially a documented non-American citizen. 7 years. If I weren't a persistent SOB, I would have given up along the way, but it was a procedure I've never known anyone to follow, so it was a challenge. I know not another person owning the document I hang on my wall, a certificate of loss of nationality of the United States. Initially, I pursued this on a lark, feeling I could not simultaneously be a loyal citizen of the United States, where I was born, and Canada, where I was granted citizenship in 1978. It occurred to me that a copy of my denaturalization certificate would be a handy item to have on my person in case of a hijacking by anti-American fanatics. Not me. I can prove I'm not an American warmonger. I am merely a Canadian running dog lackey. So I won my document, forgot about it. I'm quite glad I went through that convoluted procedure after my sister-in-law, also an immigrant from the U.S., received a message from the American government. It informed her that dual citizens of the U.S. must, on pain of fine or imprisonment, use only an American passport when crossing their border. She and her husband visit the U.S. a couple of times a year, as they have kin there. They've always used their Canadian passports for identification, but now must jump through the hoops of obtaining a U.S. one. Is this new rule just a money grab, or is it part of their ongoing program of pursuing perfect knowledge of where their citizens are and what they are doing? Who knows? I've no reason nor inclination to ever go to the United States again, but should I have the occasion, I will proudly present my precious document to the border paranoids. See you in Guantanamo, eh? This is CFUR at 88.7 FM in Prince George. We mustn't forget the tools used by official paranoids in their hunt for miscreants among us. I refer to those massive banks of supercomputers housing the programs of Carnivore and Echelon. These screen billions of emails, telephone calls, tweets, and Twitters for messages carrying words which may indicate disloyalty to the regimes of the day. The words they seek are not announced, but it takes little imagination to guess them. This is an ideal system for catching the naive and stupid. Can you believe a smart terrorist would send anything but innocent euphemisms? Get real. These sophisticated programs snag braggarts and fools. Certain anarchists have suggested that every innocent email should attach a signature block with a list of nasty words, like kill, assassinate, bomb, nuclear, Al-Qaeda, explosives, etc. I would never do such, nor would I sprinkle a telephone conversation or a radio show with such, just for the record. The American political establishment has arisen in righteous indignation at a serious violation of international law by the Taliban. They captured an American soldier and released a videotape of him. Doesn't this just demonstrate the perfidious nature of the enemy? Of course, the U.S. has a narrow platform from which to accuse the Taliban of violating the rules of warfare. It's not the Taliban who invaded another country without sanction or threat to themselves. They may be an abusive, nasty bunch of superstitious bastards, but they perform their misdeeds within their own land, on their own people. It's American soldiers who shoot civilians in the streets of another nation or bomb them from the air. It's Americans who introduced mercenaries into this far land, freeing them of legal restraints from either the U.S. or a puppet Afghan regime, and on and on. Considering the whole picture, it's amusing to hear the U.S. decry violations of civilized behavior. Let's ignore the doom and gloom talk about growing layoffs and bankruptcies. Being the consummate optimist, I look for the silver lining within that dark cloud of despair. It warms my heart to learn that bonuses are back in fashion on Wall Street. Yes, the very firms, now there's an interesting term, the recklessness of which inflated, then pricked the financial bubble for which we are all paying, have reverted to form. Goldman Sachs Group plans to pay out $20 billion this year, an average per employee higher than 2007's largesse of $661,000. Morgan Stanley will pay over $11 billion in compensation to its stars. Surely these grand rewards will be spread about by their recipients, eventually trickling down and making the average person prosperous. Ain't capitalism grand? Canada has always been ambivalent toward refugees. International agreements oblige us to provide shelter for those fleeing homelands in fear of their safety. Of course, this is subject to interpretation. In effect, application of this obligation is quite flexible. In last century, Canada turned away a shipload of Sikhs, who might have been considered refugees. Then, in the run-up to World War II, we rejected a ship full of Jews fleeing Nazi persecution. With the candid comment that one is too many, we returned them to Europe, where the bulk were exterminated like rats. We can't deny that those Jews were legitimate refugees, but at that time, our leaders were determined to keep Canada a white Christian nation. They already had enough trouble trying to snuff out the pesky native culture to be bothered with a bunch of the fundamentalists among our leaders considered Christ killers. The days of uniformly white Christian Canada are behind us, so we can no longer have that dubious rationale for excluding those of different hue and culture. But subtle racism remains behind a facade of impartiality. Until very recently, Stephen Harper refused to fill vacancies in refugee adjudicating boards, then blamed bogus claimants for a massive backlog of cases. Conservatives entered into an agreement with the U.S., obliging refugees to make their claim only within the first in which they set foot. Latin Americans transiting the United States will no longer be considered refugees in Canada and will be turned back to the tender mercies of a system intent upon rejecting them. We precipitously laid a visa requirement on Mexicans after as many as 9,500 visitors claimed to be fleeing drug gang violence at home. We did the same with Czechs, as a whole 1,720 Roma visitors sought refugee status in Canada based on ongoing persecution in their home country. If either those Czechs or Mexicans were wealthy entrepreneurs, they'd be welcomed with open arms. On the horizon, we foresee a new class of potential intruder, the climate refugee. How will Canada deal with them? According to the Economic and Political Weekly, there are now about 24 million persons displaced by climate change. By the time Canada suffers through the Olympic fiasco, this number is projected to be 50 million, rising to 150 million by 2050. Oxfam predicts that 375 million people per year will be affected by climate-related disasters by 2015. Kofi Annan's Global Humanitarian Forum claims that we already have 300,000 deaths annually due to climate variations, and 500 million are at extreme risk. River deltas in India and Bangladesh have lately seen a rise of over 3 centimeters a year as increased glacier runoff meets rising sea levels. This caused disappearance of 80 square kilometers of land in the last 30 years. There are 4 million people living on delta islands who will not stand peacefully and drown as waters rise. Where will they go? The Maldives Islands are being inundated, so inhabitants must all move to higher land. Where will they go? Deserts are expanding and some becoming intolerable. Agricultural areas of our prairies in Australia are creating internal refugees. Where do we fit them in? How do we replace their foods? The Red Cross estimates that climate refugees are outnumbering those displaced by wars and persecution. Developed countries have two choices. We can try to integrate a share of climate refugees, or we can fortify our lands against these people. The United States has given their unspoken answer by building walls, physical and virtual, against the desperate. Our imposition of new visa requirements seem to indicate the conservatives' direction. Failure of nations to provide safe haven for environmental refugees would exacerbate the danger of failing democracies, such as they are, and wars over water and lands. The choices are no easier in times of economic recession and rising domestic unemployment. Watch to see how nations react to this dangerous situation. My prediction is that Canada, under liberals or conservatives, will opt for a Fortress Canada policy, excluding all immigrants and refugees, but those who can buy their way to the head of the queue. We need to go no further than our local post office, or its scab replacement, to have a good indication of where our society has wandered in the last century or so. America's first postage stamps honored George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, and Benjamin Franklin. Last week, I received a letter from Hawaii with colorful stamps honoring the Simpson family, not O.J.'s, but Homer's. Canada began printing stamps bearing likenesses of Queen Victoria, Prince Albert, and the Beaver. Today's Canadian post offices flog 54-cent wonders featuring Prince George's septic tank-headed Mr. P.G. and Watson Lake's forest of stolen signs. Where in hell are we going? Watson Lake, Yukon, boasts a jumble of pilfered signs from every province, every state, and many other countries. I wondered how the keepers of those hot items would have reacted if I showed up requesting space for a sign reading, "Welcome to Watson Lake." I wasn't yet in my teens when a neighbor gave me guns. His glory days passed as a Marine chasing Japanese across Pacific Islands. He returned to the States to wear a necktie, working in his daddy's business, marry, and sire two daughters. He really wanted sons he could groom for the Marines, and for a time he sort of took me on as a surrogate. I can't understand why my parents allowed this, but the guy gave me a .22 pistol, a .32 revolver, and a large Japanese officer's pistol of undetermined caliber. I played with these like cap pistols, and no one in the neighborhood seemed to bat an eye. I even packed the .32 to school one day without repercussions. Can you imagine if a kid pulled a stunt like that in Canada today? There would have been a lockdown if he were lucky, and he'd be shot if unlucky. 3 years of military service changed my attitude toward guns. I went from thinking they were fun to having a healthy respect for them as killing machines. They're suitable toys for neither children nor adults. Many Americans, in spite of an outrageous toll of firearms deaths, still have a love affair with guns. The National Rifle Association, a vocal and powerful minority, bolstered by a perverse reading of their Second Amendment to their Constitution, pushes for ever more gun owner privileges. Their latest victories are in Tennessee and Arizona, where their 375,000 registered gun owners won the right to carry concealed arms into bars and eating places. As for me, I will not be comforted knowing that the two guys arguing in the corner might settle their differences Wild West style. I worked in a Gary, Indiana steel mill for a year. At that time, Gary had a reputation as a wild town with a corrupt political structure. One co-worker was a large, powerful individual who talked little, but when he spoke, others listened. He missed work one day, and we soon found out why. He'd gone to one of our city's speakeasies, an unlicensed bar, where they required guns to be checked at the door. he dutifully checked two pistols. During the course of an evening, got into an altercation and pulled a gun. As I said, we listened to him. I'm ever grateful that such men are rare in Canada. Even Prince George. Before moving to Canada, I lived and worked in Oakland, California, another city not ranked highly on the law and order scale. This was the birthplace of both the Black Panther for self-defense and the Hell's Angels. City fathers had a reputation for recruiting cops from amongst racist southern whites, and those in the black ghetto did not appreciate their style of enforcing laws, guns drawn and often shooting. So Oakland was, shall I say, an interesting place for a young man, but its appeal faded as I grew older. After immigrating to Canada, I paid a visit to old friends in Oakland. One of them pulled open a drawer and proudly showed me his latest acquisition, a chrome-plated 45 caliber military-style automatic. He'd bought it on a lark. Later that day, at another friend's house, I told him of seeing this pistol. This guy said, "That's nothing," whereupon he went to a closet and pulled down the largest handgun I ever saw, a 44 Magnum. "What in the world do you want with that?" He replied that California Highway Patrol used a smaller bore handgun, a mere 357 Magnum, to blow the engine out of a car refusing to stop, and he thought it would be cute to have them outgunned. I don't miss California all that much. A court decision struck down Section 377 of the Indian Penal Code, which criminalized, quote, "carnal intercourse against the order of nature," close quote. This law was a legacy of British colonial rule, not in keeping with the ancient tolerance of sexual practices their foreign masters found abhorrent. Remember the Kama Sutra? India is no longer among the 80-odd countries with anti-gay laws still on their books. This fact is not universally applauded by Indians. Their opponents? The usual suspects, Christian churches as well as Hindus, Muslims, and Sikhs. The superstitious, basing their dubious, rigid moralities on old books, are again in the forefront of opposing change. Just like at home, eh? I'll give due credit to those progressive religious groups in the West which don't march in lockstep with reactionaries. They're good folks out there who value human rights over rules established by men who thought the earth was flat. John Manley has replaced Tom DeKino as mouthpiece for Canada's corporate sector. For years, I heard Tom quoted every time the CBC wanted a spokesman for business. Under Tom, the Business Council on National Issues changed its name to the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, a more apt description of their membership. It remains to be seen whether John can bring a more balanced slant to their propaganda. The CCE has earned itself a bit of a bad reputation over the years. It was they who advanced deregulation. They defended outrageous bonuses and golden handshakes for their members. Governments slavishly followed their advice, slashing corporate taxes while eliminating oversight. Following the failure of this no-holds-barred free-for-all capitalist experiment, governments have not punished the class which milks society so effectively. They bailed out the guilty while their victims have been largely left to fend for themselves after their social safety net was shredded at the behest of the rich, so their taxes could be reduced to a nuisance level. If Manley intends to soften the right-wing edge of the Canadian Council of Chief Executives, he has his work cut out for them. This has been the 321st edition of Uncle Don's Porcupine Petting Zoo on CFUR at 88.7 FM. Chin up. You make a better target that way.